Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another conversation between myself and the Shetan Mecca. We've touched so far on anarcho-tyranny, the future of managerialism, and we also, during the course of that conversation, had cause more than once to talk about Pareto's distinction between the class ones and the class twos, or the foxes and the lions. This has been topical because it was also discussed on the Lotus Eaters recently, where the Dan Tubbs was trying to argue that Trump was a lion, as against my denials of this claim. Before we get going here, where can people find you?
Shadow Maker, Shetan Mecca. They can find me on YouTube. Just type in the title of my channel or go to the link below this video, I think. And under every of my videos on YouTube, there's a link to my Twitter handle, to my email. So if you have a more detailed question, you can find me there and write me a message.
I'll just remind everyone, pick up a course at the Academic Agency today. Trivium, the bestseller, Foundations of Shakespeare also. At the end, there's also a course by Eric Kaufman at the University of Buckingham. I'll play the video towards the end of this video. So, foxes and lions, class one and class two. We've already touched on this in some detail in our previous conversation, but I do think it's worth asking ourselves about the validity of this analysis by Machiavelli and Pareto. Is it still useful for us? What is it? And then we can kind of take things from there. So in a nutshell, the class one and the class two, the fox and the lion, do you see this as useful? And, you know, for people who aren't aware of it, what is the basic idea?
Yeah, the basic idea, as we already described in a previous video, is that the class one types are the administrated most often in periods of peace. They're good with administration, good with art, good with media and information manipulation. The softer types that we see in our regimes and class two, they are usually good with war, with police work. You could think of some German general or some Guderian or some Roman general in that time. And yeah, then seldomly there are mixed types, like classically would be Julius Caesar, who was very good with politics, but also was a capable master of war. And theory has it that in our times, we live in a class one dominated society. More recent examples of a class two dominated society would be Stalinist Russia or National Socialist Germany. And an example of a mixed regime would maybe be the American government in the 19th century, because there was such a plethora of tasks to fulfill. You build the industry, expand into the West. So there was a lot of opportunity for both classes to get into positions of power. So that's the basic theory. And yeah, is this still useful? I think to some degree it is. It is, of course, a very rough approximation to reality. I mean, people are not easily cast into boxes like this. But I think it is hard to imagine, which with a lot of politicians that we see today who are very good in spinning the narrative, who see every problem as a public relations problem, to imagine them controlling troops or commanding troops. It's at least much harder to imagine that in comparison to Adolf Hitler or Joseph Stalin controlling troops. Even if they are not very good sometimes in making strategic decisions, their character is more suited for that. Now, is this still valid today? I think since we have only seen managerial wars, basically, so the Vietnam War and the Iraq War, although it was fought by physical means, it was never a war that a class two individual would want to fight, or it was never fought in a way that he would approach things. And since all of these wars basically got lost for the United States, who fought them under a class one managerial premise, I think it is worth considering that still there is much to gain on the field of physical conflict if a regime would switch to class two individuals.
Yeah, I mean, on the Vietnam War, it's not an exaggeration to say, you know, Robert McNamara, it was a spreadsheet war. He literally maintained a spreadsheet of total numbers killed. We just need to kill more than them. And if my spreadsheet says we've killed this many Vietnamese, that means we win. It's kind of, I'm not even making this up. That's literally what happened.
Yes, yes.
And in fact, it manifests itself today. I mean, I think Vladimir Putin has started to show lion characteristics, you know, with his willingness to use force in to solve situations. Now, you could argue some aspects of that have been quite clumsy from the Russians. But from the other end, I do see a lot of fox-like class one thinking when it comes to that war and when it comes to Russia. How many times have you seen a NAFO bro say things like, well, if you just add up the GDP of all of the European nations, it's this many times more than Russia's. And therefore, because we have the big, literally because we've got the bigger number, therefore we win.
Yeah, a lot of times. And of course, this is not unimportant. I mean, McNamara's strategy of spreadsheeting the war is very good when it comes to logistics and resources. So it's not useless. So class one talents are not useless in a modern war on the whole scale. But yeah, to win a war, to actually win a war, as we have seen in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and also as we see with the, let's say, more civil, social-like wars or, criminal situations with the cartels, let's say, in Mexico and America, to actually win the war, you would need the willingness to apply force in a much more direct and ruthless manner. I mean, the mafia or the great cartels in America are a good example. Within the class one regime that took over all of European nations since the Second World War, the criminal organizations in them all flourished. I mean, the mafia was never as powerful, as rich as it is today or in the recent decades. And the same is true for the Mexican cartels. So why is that? Because under fascism, on the other hand, Mussolini sent Iron Prefect to Sicily, and the mafia went into hiding for a decade. And if the fascist regime in Italy would have held on for longer, maybe they would have disappeared altogether. That is an open question. But we see, since he was willing to ruthlessly incarcerate these people, he had more success with fighting the organized crime. Now, when I hear people's opinion about the conflict with the cartels in Mexico and America today, they always say, yeah, send in the Delta Forces, send in the Navy SEALs. But this is the wrong strategy. That is class one's thinking. That is just one-upping the technical expertise of the soldiers that you're fighting against some ragtag cartels. No, the fighting power of the Mexican army is by far enough to handle the Mexican cartels physically. The problem is you are not willing to eradicate these criminal organizations by the mean that would be necessary and that would approximate partisan eradication. So you are not willing to go to every town and every city and just raid every home that you suspect of inhabiting a cartel member and then just put them on the wall and shoot them. So because you're not willing to do this, which class two people probably would do, you are not able to handle the problem for good. And this is why we see these endlessly protracted conflicts.
Now, recently there's been a situation where there was an attempt, or there has been attempts, to become a bit more lionish, you could say. And this was, of course, in America, in Minnesota, and the whole, ICE, this woman, Renee Good, was killed, and there was subsequently Alex Petit. Now, I have been very critical of some of the behavior I've seen there from, people like Matt Walsh and various other, some even friends of mine, Americans. Because what I saw, again, was not, it has the appearance of lion.
Exactly, behavior, it's just an appearance.
But it is, there's so much what I have called performative sadism with all of that, okay? The memes and the making fun and the glorying in it. And in a way, it was done in such a LARPy and non-serious manner that it undermined what actually... So when I imagine the lion regimes of old behaving, okay? We mentioned Stalin. Mm-hmm. I'd imagine it being done with a kind of pity. The word I would use is pitilessness.
Yeah.
A kind of grim pitilessness. Okay. Where it's like, well, I'm just, you know, carrying out what needs to be done, as opposed to, I'm like, I cannot imagine that, you know, the Reds were kind of memeing about, the, like with, you know, like you understand what I mean, right? They knew what needed to be done and they carried out their duty, as opposed to this massive kind of dance, song and dance and performance parade. Which has the dual function of G-ing up your enemies, G-ing up your actual organized enemies, the left in this case, and the media, the foxes, if you want, G-ing those up, emboldening them, while at the same time showing that you're not actually the real deal. That's what it said to me. That's one of the reasons I've been so critical.
Yeah.
How is it possible for people who basically come from a fantasy version of the world, lived through television, lived through Netflix, lived through media and social media now, you know, the Matrix, as you want to call it, which is drenched in class one type thinking. And even more importantly, how can I explain this? Like the class one projection of what they imagine class two power to be, right? And yeah. So when you try to embody that, you're not actually embodying that, but a cartoon version of it imagined by a fox in the first place. Do you understand? Like,
people can, also the instrument that people can use to differentiate between these spheres is, yeah, the role, for example, of media. Media in information distribution, information manipulation is classically a class one society characteristic. So the more it is done of that in proportion to the violence that is applied, the more sure you can be that we still live in a class one regime. For example, the Gulag deportations and all what happened in the Soviet Union. Yes, some of this was put into the media or some of it was used for propaganda, but in proportion of all the millions of lives that were perishing at this time, or they were deported into gulags, the media coverage of this was rather low. And the same happened in the National Socialist German regime. So the proportion between media coverage and propaganda and memes that you can build and you do build out of that and the actual violence or the actual physical force is applied is a good criterion of which regime we live in. So that's the first. And the second is, I think, how realistic is the threat to the regime as a whole as a consequence of the action that is taken? For example, if somebody in Mexico would do what I just described, so partisan eradication basically for the cartel members, after this is done, we basically have some troop commander who just killed 500,000 people, because that is the estimated number that of people working directly for the cartels. And then the government says, okay, lay down your weapon and resolve. And he says, no. Will there be a critical situation for the state? And I think in such a situation, it would be. And in the case of ICE or so, it wouldn't. I think there is no realistic threat from ICE to the government as a whole. And I think these two criteria are good to see and to gauge how far we have gotten from the class one dominated society to a class two society.
Very, very interesting. One of the things I've often thought about is, so we've been talking about, you know, ICE and, you know, the prospect of a populist party wielding force in that way. What about the other scenario? I mean, we started to see it actually during the COVID era. You know, you think of Justin Trudeau cracking down on the truckers, right? Yeah. Or in this country, Keir Starmer putting people in jail for tweets, or, you know, there was the Southport riots and that he actually had kind of turbo courts which tried people within a week, like, i.e. the normal course of justice was accelerated to make sure that he got 100 people in jail or whatever in the space of 1 week. These are little baby steps, you could say, for the old soft managerial left regime becoming more hard managerial or starting to use some of the tools of the foxes. One of the things I've thought about is that if they choose to go that route, and there's nothing actually saying that they won't at some point go down that route, will it create a crisis within the system because of the source of person who is required to carry out that task? I mean, in the modern parlance, the sorts of people who need to do those things tend not to have been people who study PPE at Oxford or Cambridge, right? They tend to come from rougher backgrounds, or maybe they've come through the army, or maybe they've gone through. I mean, if you actually have a look at the people who've done this sort of stuff in history, who actually form Class Two elites, you can have a look. The Bolsheviks for a decade were in and out of jail, maybe even more than a decade, living rough, actually doing armed robberies and things like that. Or if you have a look at the mid-century Germans, every single one of them to a man was a World War One veteran.
Yeah.
Okay. Who'd actually been in the trenches. So what I'm saying is, in order for our leftist kind of system to go hard managerial, it requires a different stripe of person. Then they would actually have to try to find those people. But then in a strange way, could they end up turning themselves they try to become the thing that they're trying to avoid in the process of trying to make that transition?
Yeah, I mean,
you understand what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, yeah. Two parts to this. The first, yes. I mean, it is hard to imagine that we can really muster a great force of Class Two individuals from our society, because even if we have people who are characteristically prone to it, they have no experience in that because we live in peace and prosperity now for so long. Yes, something like the First World War or some rougher times to ennoble these characteristics in men would be very helpful, at least. That is true, and maybe this is also necessary. Maybe we first have to go through a big crisis, an economic crisis, something like this, in order to make regime change happening. So, but the second question is also very interesting. Can the current regime just transform into one? And I think the answer is here more clearly no. I think it would have to be, they would feel threatened by this, because even if necessity demands them to be more physical, they simply can't. And you can see this in a lot of politicians that come from the Green Party or from the socialist parties. You can see in these persons that they could never command physically demanding tasks. So is it possible that within a party there is a revolution of personality so that Class Two individuals come to the top? Yeah, this is thinkable. But I think the current regime is also very afraid of that, because they saw, but at least implicitly, they know or saw what happened with Stalin's Russia. They can feel that as soon as these talents are demanded in society, that their own currency of talents diminishes, devalues. Yeah, nobody needs the big media manipulator. Nobody needs the public relations expert if you're killing people on the street and everybody knows it. I mean, it's hard to come back to these talent sets then. So, and I think this is the main reasons why the regime is still reluctant to use full force. I mean, we could always ask ourselves, if the regime is so powerful, why don't they just transform into a world like 1984 and really make sure that they never lose power because they are in full physical dominance over society? And I think the reason is that if you have to do this, or if you would do this, you would bring people into power that have Class Two characteristics and that are a threat to your own position of power, because you did not came into power by commanding physical violence, but by manipulating the media. I think this is a tension that cannot be eradicated in men and in society.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things I want to mention here. One is that this conversation we're having is not purely, I mean, in the case of Germany,
yeah,
there have been headlines suggesting that the government could just flat ban the AfD, even though, how many people in, was it like a quarter of Germans, a third of Germans even?
A quarter, no. A good quarter, and in the East, even 40%, yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, they have seriously toyed with this idea of just flat banning this party, or of locking up, persecuting its members and so on. So this is not just a theoretical discussion we're having. This is something that has been floated and touted in the media. But you're suggesting that they could never go there. They could never actually take that step.
Well, never never comfortably. Maybe they have to do it in a panic reaction someday, yes, but I don't think they are comfortable with this. If they would be comfortable, they would have already done it. I mean, in the Soviet Union, the AfD would not exist. So, but in our regime, it does. All of this talk about banning this party, banning that organizations, maybe it happens with very small organizations, but there is also a lot of the fear that we previously discussed the other way around in the context of ICE. So all the memes that just are put into public in replacement of actual violence. This is also the case here, just with the sides reversed. All of this talk about banning the AfD is a certain sign that they are not comfortable with that. If they would be comfortable with it, they would just do it and not talk so much about it. And what they fear is that after they have banned the AfD, they encounter more persistent resistance, I guess, that they have to be even more physical than they are comfortable with. I think this is what I assume. It is possible that this is a panic reaction, but I don't think, they are comfortable with that.
Well, one of the very strange phenomena that, one of many reasons I'm interested in Stalin, but also many other communist regimes too, is that when they make this transition, and this is perfectly predicted by Pareto, When the elite become class two, the tastes of the regime change to reflect them. And what is class two? It's more conservative.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's socially conservative. It's distrustful of. So, like, for example, in communist Russia, this also happened in Cuba and many other places. When they went lion in that way, they ended up saying things like, well, homosexuality is a bourgeois affectation. Yes. Or it's actually fascism to be a homosexual. So they banned, Stalin made, he made divorce more difficult. He actually instituted traditional Russian family life in various different ways. He changed the aesthetics to make them more nationalistic. Partly that was driven by the needs of the war as well, but you understand what I'm saying, right?
Yes,
is that
sure.
Viewed from a leftist perspective, the Soviet Union took a rightwards turn at the moment when it became more lionish. You could argue the same in Cuba as well. They were still communists, of course, but on all of those other issues, they were outwardly quote unquote conservative. And I wonder if the because so many of the people in our regime are leftists, do you think they're actually aware of this? Do you think they're aware, well, look, if we empower these lions to put away our enemies, it's only a matter of time before they're you can't make a kind of shock squad of blue-haired lesbians and troops, right? It's going to end up being men with these tastes at the end of the day, and that's what they're terrified of. So it's a double bind for them.
I don't think that most of them are explicitly aware of it. Yeah, maybe some people who have a deep knowledge of political history and all of these things are. But I think implicitly they are, because in every concrete situation, then they feel that something is going against their grain. For example, if a police commander has to be appointed that is very clearly not a leftist, very clearly a rough figure, then there's immediate protest, then there's immediate struggle to get him demoted or something like this. So I don't think that they have a good formulated theory. I think the left has devalued itself in intellectual prowess, so they don't bring forth these clear theories anymore as they did in the, let's say, maybe early 20th century. But on an implicit level, on a gut level, they do. And I think often this is enough. I think what is often, the political system is sort of as explicitly engineered. But I don't think it happens this way. It happens the other way around, like in evolution. I mean, in evolution, there is no big guidance, no person who comes up with new ideas and then implements them into nature. No. There are a set of ideas, and then the bad ideas get selected away. And I think this is the same what happens in a political sphere. There, let's say, five people rise into positions of power and three people prove to be not to the leftist taste and they get demoted again, or they get not, they don't rise in the ranks further. And I think this is how the system works, not by explicit engineering, but by implicit evolution.
But the basic problem they've got is that they can't lock up the chuds, because in order to so, they need to empower chuds to lock up other chuds.
Exactly.
And then you still end up with empowered chuds.
Right. Well, they can't lock up the chuds, and we, by that, accumulate the residues that we were talking at the beginning of our conversation. We have just resistant elements in our society, not just angry white people, but also Islamists and these cartels we spoke about, that just don't go away by the means of class one. They cannot be manipulated away. They are too violent or too resistant or whatever. For whatever reason, they cannot be put under control. They cannot be contained fully. And I think these elements have become more severe in nature and more numerous over time. And the question is, to what endpoint will this lead? Will the regime have a panic reaction and transform into a class two society? Will these disorderly elements take over? But I don't think that the trajectory of life as that we observe at the moment can go on like this for eternity. I think that is impossible.
Fascinating. Why don't we talk a little bit before we wrap up? The Lotus Eaters recently did this whole roundtable on whether Trump is a lion or not. And one of the things that Dan Tubbs was talking about is that, well, look, he's a starter lion. He's a kind of like the lion who comes before the true lion, or something like this. What do you make of this idea that in order for the lion to come, there needs to be these kind of like sneak previews, like maybe he's not, like the stepping stone idea? Because I look at history, I don't really see this idea of the sneak preview lion who comes as a stepping stone towards the true lion. I can't think of any examples. And you know, I made that video before looking at Alfred Hugenberg and Farage, and I was like, look, Alfred Hugenberg didn't believe in democracy. He was like, by any normal definition, already kind of pretty far on the way to what ended up happening. You can't, like, when people say, well, Farage is a stepping stone to what needs to happen, like, Hugenberg wasn't there selected by the Weimar Republic as a containment mechanism on behalf of the permanent German bureaucracy, which is what Farage is. And he wasn't funded by, like, foreign enemies of the country either, right? He genuinely was who he was. And he ended up genuinely being a stepping stone towards something else. The situation with these sorts of these populist figures now, I just don't see this argument. I don't know why it's taken seriously that this is a necessary step. If anything, I see the opposite. I think they are there to prevent, that their entire reason for being there is to prevent the emergence of any genuine countervailing force to the system, to basically contain the energies there, and then in the long term, when they fail, discredit it, to therefore strengthen, like re-strengthen the center or something like this, or cause a leftist backlash, something like this, not as a stepping stone to somebody further on in that way. That's my assessment, but how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, sure, on an absolute scale, Hugenberg was obviously more right-wing than anybody alive today. But still, Hitler was more extreme and more right-wing and more uncontrollable than Hugenberg was. And Hugenberg commented in his time about this, that he is horrified by who he brought in power there. But, I mean, I think, let's take the example of Weimar Germany and Hugenberg and Hitler. I mean, with Hugenberg's power and Hugenberg's media influence, Hitler could come into a situation where the regime tried to contain him. So they tried to put him into a government where he basically would have no power. He would be chancellor, but without any real power. But Hitler was not doing it. Hitler got into the situation, but then was behaving so erratically or so radically that he could break out of this containment and revolutionize the Weimar Republic to his own good, and then brought the party into power for good. Roughly in outline, if you are interested in this, you can probably read more details. So is this, so now comparable to the situation we face today. Is the stepping stones theory useful? I don't know that, because I mean, this is a close poker decision. This is like having a lower pair against ace king or something like this. So it's about 50-50. Yeah, you risk a lot if you go for the stepping stone theory, because you let yourself willingly be contained, but on the other hand you have maybe a stepping stone. So it very much depends on the situation. But what we can see, what is very interesting, is something like the Tocqueville effect, that by which we can gauge the situation. So Tocqueville said the actual revolution will not happen if the resistance of the regime that is to be revolutionized is the heaviest. So if a regime just clamps down and becomes more violent and more stringent in their defense, then it is unlikely, even if the people suffer from it, that the revolution will happen. The revolution will happen when the regime takes a part into the direction of the revolutionaries. So they try to appease them, or they try to contain them. They try to go a step into this direction. But this is often a good situation where the revolutionary forces can take over, because the dam is broken, so to say. So, and that makes this decision that you're describing so difficult, because we have social forces in both directions, and this is such a close call. And to give a definite answer is probably impossible. It depends on the people that are in. I mean, Hitler was, in many regards, as was Stalin, a unique individual, and it takes this uniqueness to push the scale on this close decision into the wrong direction or the other. So maybe Farage is not the right person for this, but I would not rule out that a situation like you're describing is useful for the right-wing forces.
Interesting. Very interesting indeed. We may have to agree to disagree on this. I mean, maybe I'm just so disillusioned with the with populism in general, and so just kind of disgusted by them, that I'm kind of out of patience. I've seen enough, basically. The data's in for me. But, you know, maybe I'll be pleasant.
I think that is, as I described, one of your problems, your personal problems, maybe. I think your degree of impatience is very, on a very human scale, and the human life happens on the, let's say, the scale of decades, but political revolution are prepared on the scale of at least decades, maybe half a century or so. So maybe you should adjust your expectations to what historically is expected for the length of time of strain.
Well, what I would like to see is a list of revolutions that have come about from people or individuals or parties that are openly being funded by foreign agitators. And, you know, like, I mean, got a bizarre situation of people pretending to be patriots and nationalists and so on, where actually their real agenda is serving some other country. That's what I would like to see. Like, where are the parallels for that? And I'm not saying there aren't any, because the CIA have funded plenty of coups and things like that. So, but I would like to see, you know, more of that, because part of my calculus is, without going into too much into details, is who specifically is involved in this. What, like, you know, you're making a bargain with an actor that has a pretty much 100% track record of betraying, like making a deal, betraying its allies, 0% for you, 100% for me, not giving an inch and so on. And you know, from my point of view, it's like, you know, you talk about poker, I just see the odds as 0% on the basis that it's always been 0%, and you're saying this time is going to be different. You know, this was what I call the Maloney gambit, right? The Maloney gambit is, we'll trade off the foreign policy bit, and in exchange, we'll get the domestic bit. She gave them the foreign policy bit. She didn't get jack shit at home. Jack shit. She ended up saying, I love immigration. Right?
Yeah.
This is the issue over and over again, is that you, and this is why I struggle to compare current actors with some of these historical players, because these historical players were the genuine, like, you know, many people will hate the people that we're talking about, but you can say that they were the authentic, genuine article. They weren't secretly being controlled by some other group. This is, in my view, the biggest problem that's come from, you know, for all of the benefits that you may have got from Trump or, you know, the populist revolution or whatever, it's come with a whole set of negative baggage that's going to take a long time to shake. And maybe it's going to take like continuous cycles. Maybe these people have to have 5 years in power so that they can disappoint you and show you that they're not serious. But the problem is you're now 5 years down the line again. You see what I'm saying?
Right. The problem is, I think the most productive way dealing with this very real problem is to deconstruct the problems into smaller, more identifiable bits. If you just say, okay, this is all controlled opposition or this populism, it can never work from any angle, then it's hard to proceed from that. But if you say, for example, okay, you have a chance of revolution that starts with 50%, but it gets diminished to almost 0% if you're foreign influence or foreign finance, okay, then foreign financing is the thing that you cannot compromise on. And if it's giving up Farage or the party or the AfD, I think the AfD has not the same problem, as at least not to the same degree of severity. But if this is the factor, then we should identify that and insist on that. But it becomes more productive then to break down the problems into things that you can tolerate and think that you can't. And sure, everybody has to ask himself if the decision that he makes or the opinions that he has about foreign influence is realistic, or if it's just fueled by the your own anger about the situations. But I can imagine that foreign influence is a very negative contribution to the political process that you want to reach, and you should prohibit it. And then maybe you should also be consequent or on that and not vote for the AfD, for example, if they would be founded by a foreign nation to an obvious degree. I can see that. But in the way I'm describing, I think you have more chance to improve the situation on a problem-specific manner and not just look at the entangled situation, political situation as a whole, and never make any progress.
Yes. Some good points made, I'll grant you.
Yeah, but otherwise, how should you proceed, right? I mean, this is sometimes, if I would, I mean, I don't play poker professionally or chess professionally. I play it sometimes in as a hobby. But if I don't get better, if I see that I'm stuck and I'm angry about that, then I always recognize that the true anger is not with making bad decisions or with having bad experience, but with not knowing how to proceed. As soon as I know how to improve my skills, then I can take this path and I can accept the setbacks. It's only when you put in front of an insurmountable mountain of problems that you don't not and you do not know any path forward that you get really angry and frustrated. And I think this is something we should prevent.
My view at the moment is that the error that the right falls into continually, what gives them a lifetime supply worth of fell for it again, right, is basically becoming what has been termed as the rightoid. I forget who it was on Substack who wrote this great article on identifying the rightoid mindset. You know, in this country, it's the frothing at the mouth gammon who literally is so starving for red meat that they'll, you know, lap up anything that they're fed, okay, by, used to be the Tory party, now it's Farage and so on. And to me, if you're analyzing the poker game and you've lost literally 100 hands in a row, you have to do something different.
Yes.
Hope it, like doing the same thing again and hoping for a different outcome, to me, is the definition of madness. So my view is, people somehow have to shake themselves out of the mindset of the rightoid, right? The rightoid. This is like the ultimate, you know, if you want to picture the rightoid, it's the guy who's got every Fell for It Again award, the guy who, does the outrage performance for every headline that is thrown your way. Most of those headlines written by your enemies, by the way.
Yeah.
Right, it's the guy who willingly lets the hand up his proverbial backside to be ventriloquized and made a puppet for somebody else. The person who will not learn the lesson of your anger, their agenda. Right, this to me has become an acute problem in the current moment. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I've kind of been on the trajectory I have, because until that is learned, until there's a level of seriousness to not become that rightoid, we're going to be stuck in this loop forever. Right.
I can understand the problem. I can also understand the problem of outrage culture and all of that. Now, how would I proceed, or how would I recommend not falling into this trap? What helped me always is to take a step back from immediate politics, from immediate outrage, Twitter headlines, all of that, and try to find an article or an essay about a topic of interest to current political events that is not written from an overtly political point of view. So, for example, for me, it was for a while population dynamics and the green questions written by people who were already in the movement from the in the 70s. So they were not progressive, but they were green and they were writing about this. And then get into entrenched in this topic and really try to formulate an opinion on your own based on a lot of numbers and a lot of thinking, and then come back to the political discussion. Now, this takes you some weeks, but that you can take as a cool off period from the outrage, but also it settles you on an issue in a far deeper mode. I think a lot of these problems arise also because people are only very superficially informed about things, and they have only formulated their opinion based on emotional parameters. Now, these emotional parameters are not unimportant, but I think to have a deeper political movement, you should do what I described, to get involved with the real matter. And also, I did this for political theory itself. When I was 18 or 20, the political system was a big mystery to me. I mean, it was not completely democratic, or it did not work as advertised. I could clearly identify that, but it was only after I read Pareto and Mosca and all of these people and St. Francis that I got a clear picture of what actually is going wrong. And I think this process can be repeated, and it is to the benefit of the individual in the political struggle. I deeply think that.
Fantastic. All right. Well, where can people find you again?
They can find me on YouTube, Der Schattenmacher, The Shadow Maker. You can just find my YouTube channel there, and below every video, my email and my Twitter handle are linked. So if you feel inclined to write me a message, go ahead.
Now, just remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency. Speaking of courses, as I mentioned at the start, the University of Buckingham under Eric Kaufmann at the Heterodox Center there. Now has a course that you can take on woke. I'm just going to play a quick ad for that, and then we'll say goodbye. And it's been a pleasure, sir. Hopefully we'll speak again.
Yeah, hopefully we can speak at some time in the future. It was a pleasure talking to you. I watched many of your videos when I was forming my political opinion, and now I had the great pleasure to test some of my theories and some of the theories of the books that we both read against your opinions, and obviously also against the opinion of the audience, and I'm happy to read the comments.
The ideology of our universities and many other institutions can accurately be described as woke. Woke is not an epithet, but used properly describes the dominant cultural left belief system of Western institutions. Have you ever wondered how woke came about, who believes in it, and why? Or how the culture war between woke and anti-woke forces is redefining society and politics? Well, there's good news. I've developed a 15-week online course on woke at the University of Buckingham, which is open to the global public, the first of its kind in the world. The course is not assessed, but is focused instead on deepening your understanding of woke. I offer a rigorous objective analysis of this phenomenon, similar to the way I would for fascism, communism, or any other ideology. I've studied the cultural left since the mid-1990s, and I'm ideally placed to help you understand woke. Sign up today using the attached link.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.